Welcome to the Red-Haired Archaeologist. I am your host, author, and sunscreen advocate, Amanda Hope Haley. Thanks for taking some time with me today to study artifacts our ancient Near Eastern ancestors left behind and consider if those artifacts just might change how we read or read into scripture. When we left Israel's King David at the end of the last episode, he had moved the capital of Israel from the city of Hebron up into Jerusalem. He was living there in a cedar palace with seven of his wives. The first one was a woman named Michal. She was the daughter of King Saul. Then there was Abigail, who was the widow of a very powerful Calebite at the time. And then a third one, her name was Maakah. We're going to talk about her just a little bit today. She happened to be the daughter of the king of Geshur. Well, so he's starting to consolidate his power, but they are still, Israel as a nation is still fighting wars, specifically with the Arameans and the Ammonites at this time. When we get into 2 Samuel 11, David is, we learned that one spring they are going out to war again because kings wage war during the spring. Why? That is something in the modern world we don't really think about the time of year when we go and wage our wars necessarily. But back then, it would happen in the spring because, especially in that region, weather was really a factor. And so the winter was not just cooler, but more than anything, it was the rainy season. And so when your equipment is heavy metal chariots, or even a little bit later in Israel's history, when you get to the major war, the siege machines, the war machines that would roll up to a city or something like that, you want to know that the ground that you're going to be marching on, sleeping on, pulling all this heavy equipment through, that it is not fully saturated with water. And so in the spring, obviously you have the sun coming out and there's less rain. You don't want to be fighting in wet weather if you can keep from doing that. Also, just when armies were out in the field, they had to figure out how to sustain themselves. Certainly provisions would be brought from certain places, but also they would simply hunt and gather and take care of themselves in that way. And so spring is a better time of year to do that. Animals are out moving around, grazing. They would be easier to use for sustenance simply for an army. And so we don't know a whole lot about how the army functioned early in Israel's history. We have descriptions in the Bible of the way the different divisions and everything were laid out. But from a little bit later in Israel's history, we do have ostraca, pieces of broken pottery that came from the city of Arad, and also the Lachish letters, which are probably a little bit more famous. Both of those sets of documents are letters and accounting of what happened with the armies during war. And so especially with the Lachish letters, you have these descriptions of how people were getting paid, what they were getting paid, that sort of thing. They're rather boring administrative documents, but they're actually really helpful for helping us understand what warfare looked like at the time, looked at 800-900 years prior to the birth of Christ. Well, so instead of going out in the spring and fighting alongside his men, as he had done probably every year prior to this, we learned that King David stays home and he had gone up on his roof and taken a nap. While he's up there, he happens to see a woman named Bathsheba. Her husband is actually one of his army commanders, Uriah the Hittite, and he sees her out taking her monthly cleansing bath. So it might seem strange to us that King David was taking a nap on his roof. That's sort of a funny image if you think about it, but that was incredibly common during the Iron Age. Typical houses at the time had four rooms. On the first floor, you would have the kitchen. We find evidence of tabuns, which are like ovens, just evidence of all sorts of food making, the hand mills that women would use. shoes. All of that has been found down there. Also, animals would stay on the first floor of a home. So during the day, if you owned a couple of goats or something like that, during the day, they would go outside of the city. They would go out through the gate. They would graze. In the evening, they would come back inside. This made sense for a lot of reasons. One, the animals would be protected from predators that way, from natural predators, also from human thieves. Also, during the winter, simply their body heat plus the residual heat from all the cooking activity that would have happened down there, specifically those bread ovens, all of that would end up heating the upper floor. Because on the upper floor of the home, we had these spaces where just generally life was lived. There's evidence of your women spinning wool and weaving, doing those sorts of things. Meals would be taken up on that second floor. If you go to the New Testament and we read about the Last Supper, it talks about Jesus taking his disciples into the upper room. There's nothing special about that. People ate in the upper room of their homes. That's just the way it functions. So that upper level was where life was lived. That's where people would sleep during the winter. But during the summer, people would actually go up onto the roofs. The roofs would be sown with grasses or straw or something like that, and people would sleep up there because of the cooler breezes. Also, those houses would be surrounded by a small parapet so that if you're like me and you toss and turn a little bit in your sleep, you don't actually roll off of your house. That would be a bad thing. So for him to be up there taking a nap, really not surprising to anybody hearing this story in the ancient world, even though maybe it seems a little bit strange to us. Well, so I want to note here that David is the one who is up on his roof. I know growing up, whenever I would see artistic images of this story, you'd see pictures of Bathsheba bathing on the roof. That's actually not what scripture tells us, and that's probably not what happened. David, being the king, his palace would have been built at the highest point in the area. That's just the way society was organized at the time. And so from that roof, he would have been able to look down and see what was going on everybody's roofs, or maybe even look into windows, that sort of thing. And so Bathsheba, if she was taking her monthly ritualistic bath at the end of her courses, that is something that all women did at the time. There may have been an actual bathtub involved. We have found figurines of women bathing from around this time period. That's a possibility. It is possible that she had a servant or someone else who would have been pouring water over her to do it that way. Or what I think is the most likely scenario is from where David's palace would have been from that height, he would have very easily been able to see the Gihon Spring, which had been running down in the Kidron Valley down below him. And so it's also possible that she was simply in the Gihon Spring doing her bathing there. But Bathsheba, probably not in a bathtub on her roof. And she certainly wasn't doing this as a way to try to get King David's attention or anything like that. This was actually a religious practice that she was going through at the time, trying to cleanse herself. So we hear about Bathsheba bathing, not because she was seducing David, but because of what happens next in the story. She is taking her bath, so we know where she is in her cycle. Well, then David invites her to the palace. They have sexual relations. She goes home and then finds out that she is pregnant. So the mention of the bath is so that we, the readers, know that there is no way that the child that she carried could have possibly been her husband's, who is away at war at the time. That son that she carries and gives birth to and then dies in 2 Samuel 12:19. That is what propels what happens really in the next chapter of the book. So in 2 Samuel 12:10, Nathan, who is a prophet, he's one of David's closest advisors. He's able to say some really hard things to David in the course of David's rule of Israel. He looks at David and says, "The sword shall never depart from your house." And that is a result of this interaction that he had with Bathsheba and the way that he essentially had her husband killed in the battlefield. David is, as we talked about last week, he is a man after God's own heart. He enjoyed a lot of political and military success, and he is forever known as the father of Israel. Israel is known as the house of David. So he's known for all that. But if you really look at the stories that are told in 2 Samuel, really more ink is spilled talking about his struggles and his losses. We know more about those really than we do about his successes. Well, so in the next chapter, we enter in what is one of the most difficult periods of King David's life. And that is where the fulfillment of Nathan's prophecy begins. So starting in chapter 13, the main character of the book shifts from David and Saul and that generation into the next generation, to David's children. At this point, his oldest son and heir is a man named Amnon. He is the son of Ahinoam, who is from Jezreel. It doesn't appear that she has any sort of royal connections or anything like that. That isn't described in the Bible. But he is beloved by David. He's the oldest son. He's the heir. David loves him very much. And it seems that Amnon maybe is a little bit spoiled and is used to getting everything that he wants. And in this chapter, he has decided that he is hopelessly, desperately in love with his half-sister, Tamar. With the help of some friends, he concocts a plan. He ends up raping her, and after the rape, he then turns her out of the house. David is infuriated by what Amnon does, but he doesn't actually do anything about it. It states that he's angry, but there don't seem to be any other consequences that come from David. Tamar had a full brother named Absalom, and they were both the grandchildren of the king of Geshur. Their mother, as I mentioned earlier, her name is Maakah. So for 2 years after the rape, Tamar stays with Absalom. Absalom refuses to even speak to his brother. And during this time, it seems that he is busy concocting a rather elaborate revenge plan. He ends up hosting a dinner party for all of his brothers. Amnon is among those. He comes, and once Amnon is drunk after feasting, then Absalom instructs his servants to murder him. The rest of the brothers, once this happens, they panic. They flee back down to Jerusalem. Absalom's house is a little bit north of Jerusalem. All of his brothers, they flee down south. They tell David what happened. At that time, Absalom turns. He goes the other direction. He goes north into Geshur, and he seeks asylum with his grandfather, who is the king up there. And there he stays for 3 years. After 3 years, David has a nephew, a man who is also a commander in his army. His name is Joab. He ends up traveling up to Geshur, getting Absalom, and bringing him back down to Jerusalem. Once Absalom is back in Jerusalem, and we have to understand that Absalom, since Amnon is gone, according to the law of primogeniture, as we would call it today, he is now the heir apparent. At this point, it has been 7 years since Tamar's rape, and the description we start to get of Absalom is surprisingly glowing at this point in the story, considering he just committed fratricide. Now we learn that he is an incredibly handsome individual. He has 3 sons and a daughter whom he must love. He named her after his sister. The daughter's name is Tamar as well. And he also is described as having incredibly thick, luxurious hair. And it is so difficult to cut that he only does that once per year. Considering I get my hair cut like once every 10 weeks, I cannot imagine this. but on paper, the way that he is described there, if not for having murdered his brother, then it seems that he is being described as the next king of Israel. He, like Saul, is handsome. Well, anyway, he and David end up after 2 years reconciling. David gives him a kiss, and if you stop right there, then it seems like maybe there is peace in the house of David. David has forgiven Absalom. Absalom now is the father of sons. It looks like the heirs, all of the line of succession in Israel is secure for the next few years. However, Absalom doesn't stop there. He ends up initiating a coup. He starts talking to citizens in Israel. So Jerusalem has a little bit of a wall. As we have discussed before, inside those walls, there are gates. And it's at the gates that the king, or prior to the king, judges would come. They would hold court. That's where major decisions were made. And so Absalom ends up going outside the wall of Jerusalem, standing in the road there, and intercepting people as they are coming into Jerusalem. People from all 12 different tribes are coming in. They're coming with, you know, whatever issues they may have that they need for the king to settle. And Absalom is stopping them. And he's basically saying, you know what? Your King David, he's not being really receptive. He's not being really great about listening to everybody. But hey, I'll hear your concerns and let me judge on that. And don't you think Israel would be a better place if I were king? It's essentially what he's saying to these people. He goes on doing this for a while. We're not exactly sure how long, because this is another one of those places like the height of Goliath, where the different manuscripts of the Bible differ. They tell us different things. So Absalom either engages in this activity for 40 days, for 4 years, or for possibly 40 years. Those are the three numbers that we get across the various manuscripts. I will say 40 years is probably the least likely candidate to be correct there, because later on you have the description of David's entire reign lasting for 40 years. So 40 years, probably not accurate. Maybe this goes on for 40 days. Probably not 4 years either. Maybe for 4 years. At this point, I believe it's been 7 years since Tamar was raped, and Absalom is clearly a man of patience and planning and slow execution. So anyway, he's really working hard to start to try to get people behind him, even though he is the heir apparent. He is not willing to wait for his father to die. Well, so really some these activities going on outside the wall of Jerusalem, those are unbeknownst to David as far as we know. And David ends up giving Absalom permission to go to Hebron. As far as we can tell, at that point, we don't know why Absalom is planning to go to Hebron. It seems that David doesn't know he's going to Hebron. But it becomes clear pretty quickly that the reason he went is to get himself anointed king. As you'll remember, Hebron is the place where David was twice anointed. He was anointed first by Samuel at his father's Jesse's home. Later on, he goes to Hebron and just the tribe of Judah anoints him. And then after that, all 12 tribes anoint him there at Hebron. So Hebron is the place where kings are chosen. Kings get anointed. Then, as today, Hebron was the highest place in Israel. And that makes sense, because from there you can see invading armies, all of that. It's a good strategic location. Well, long before David went there to become king, or Absalom went there for the next part of his plan, Abraham, the patriarch of all of the Israelites, he had the first activity in the area. He went and he bought a cave. It's called the Cave of Machpelah, and that is where he is buried. It's where he buried his wife, Sarah. That was why he bought it initially, was for her, but then his descendants are down there as well. And today, that cave is marked by a structure called the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. That structure was built by Herod the Great, so it's over 2,000 years old. It is still standing today, and it has the distinction of being the one building built by Herod that is still standing, but also that has been in continuous use as a religious center since it was built. At no point did that ever change. It changed who was in charge of it over time. The Christians came in, Muslims, Jews. Over time, who was in charge did change. The building has gone through some additions and remodeling and all of that. But when you stand back, in Hebron and you look upon this building, those foundation stones that are around there, those were laid 2,000 years ago by Herod the Great's workers. So it's a really fantastic site that I encourage everybody to see if they can. Today, it is divided down the middle. Half of it is a mosque. Half of it is a synagogue. And there are only 10 days out of the year for each group of people where those congregants are allowed to go in and use the entire building. Today, Hebron is the second holiest city for Jews. It is sort of tied for fourth as the fourth holiest city for Muslims. That is after Mecca and Medina, Jerusalem. And then depending on which sect of Muslims you're talking about, it would either be Damascus or Hebron would come in as number four. So it's a very important city even to this day. To learn more about this building's ancient and modern history, go back and listen to Season 2, Episode 9 of the Red-Haired Archaeologist podcast. So at Hebron, Absalom gets exactly what he's after. He gets all the 12 tribes of Israel to declare that he is king. And he then takes a group of people and they start heading back to Jerusalem. When David gets wind of this, he takes the people who are still loyal to him, his military commanders, all sorts of men, and they flee Jerusalem and they go out into the woods. David has fewer followers than Absalom. He knows this, but he makes a very smart tactical choice in going and stationing all of his men in the forest because he knew that his followers were more experienced at war than Absalom's followers would be. And this ends up working out well for him. David's group of men, they end up beating Absalom. Well, so while Absalom is in the forest, once he realizes that the people with him have lost the skirmish against David, he turns around and he leaves. And so in 2 Samuel 18:9, it says that his mule took him into the thick branches of a huge oak tree. There his hair was caught, and he dangled between the sky and the earth as his mule fled from underneath him. So here we suddenly understand why his hair was described earlier in the story. Not just that he was a handsome, healthy man who would have made a naturally great ruler, but also that ends up being integral to his demise. Once David wins, he tells everybody to go easy on Absalom. He does not want his son to be killed. But his commander and nephew, Joab, doesn't pay attention to what he said. He actively goes against David's instructions. He took three spears and, finding Absalom still dangling by his hair inside the oak, thrust them into his heart. Joab then gets 10 of the younger soldiers to strike him until he was dead. This is in 18 verses 14 and 15. So that is what happens to Absalom. David returns to Jerusalem after this, and he mourns his son. This, in a short period of time, this is the third son that we find David mourning. Bathsheba's infant who died, Amnon, and now Absalom. He mourns his son's fate, but then he also starts to take time to reconnect with all of the 12 tribes of Israel. And he ends up bringing all of Israel back under his leadership again. One of David's nicknames is Lamp of Israel. And in chapter 21, there's an instance where Israel needs to go to war again. And this time, and we know David's getting a little bit older, but his men tell him, "You can't go out to fight with us any longer. If you are killed, then the Lamp of Israel will go out." Lamps were just as important in antiquity as they are today, as artificial lighting is today. Sitting here we are at the end of October, and it is almost the end of daylight savings time, which I cannot wait for because I'm one of those people. I get up now at this time of the year, it's an hour or two before the sun rises, and cutting on my lamp is the very first thing that I do in the morning. It gets me going. It gets the blood flowing and my brain firing. Artificial light is very, very important. So I love lamps for that reason, for the very practical reason. I also love lamps because in 2004, I went on my first dig in Ashkelon, and the first intact artifact I had the absolute honor of pulling out of the ground was something that's called a bowl lamp bowl deposit. And what it is a perfectly formed bowl, a perfectly formed, never used lamp gets sat inside that bowl, and they take another bowl and flip it over on top. So you have basically a sphere that has a lamp inside of it. And the Philistines in Ashkelon and the Canaanites before them, they would then take that bowl lamp bowl deposit and bury it underneath the cornerstone or the foundation of their home as this idea of bringing light and life into the home, an idea of warmth and protection, all of that. And so for David to be called the lamp of Israel, some of that idea is behind that as well. He is the cornerstone of Israel. He is all that is good about Israel. He brings warmth and light. And of course, he has a direct connection to God for Israel as well. So I love lamps. And in 2019, I was in Israel with my husband and my parents, and they very kindly went in together and purchased a lamp for me. So if you are ever in Jerusalem, in Israel, and you have the opportunity to purchase something, make sure that you are buying from a reputable dealer, someone who is licensed with the state of Israel, someone who gives you the full paperwork that not only indicates that you have bought this, that this is a legal item, you have bought it, but something that also gives the provenance of the piece that you have purchased. And so, according to the people that I bought this from, I now have a lamp that is from Hebron. It was found in Hebron, and it is from around 1,000. And so I like to think that maybe there's just an outside chance that this lamp was actually used by David when he was there for that 7.5 years that he ruled Israel. I mean, it's probably not true, but it's sort of a lovely thought. Well, anytime you interact with artifacts, consider that in the case of these artifacts, they were buried underground for 3,000 years. They had the weight of all of the soil on them, keeping them pressed down. They were protected from light for all of this time. Well, once they're excavated, once all of that weight is off of them, once they encounter UV rays for the first time in 3,000 years, also, once they encounter the tools of archaeologists and hands, they are very, very fragile. So I have my little cotton gloves. I actually have bunches of pairs of these. You can order them in bulk for not very much. So when I go into schools and I teach kids, occasionally, if it's somebody close, I'll try to take these artifacts with me and show the kids. And the kids always like, if nothing else, playing with the gloves. I also feel like I have a Minnie Mouse moment anytime I put them on. But this is a lamp. So it is from the time of King David. It is from Hebron. And you can see it was handmade. Later lamps, over time, you see that they start to be closed in more. And you can also tell they look nicer. They're less rough and tumble. Some will have designs in them. Those were made after pottery wheels were invented. This one was actually made by hand. And part of what I love about it is, first off, you can see the soot from where this lamp was actually used. This was not part of a bowl lamp bowl deposit. This was actually used in someone's home at some point. But also just right here, when someone made it, they made the disc, and then their fingers just went right here and pinched it. And I just love lamps. I love everything about them. When we were purchasing this, the very smart antiquities dealer said to my family and me, "Oh, well, if you're getting a lamp, you should get a lamp filler." So we did. He talked us into it. And so this is a lamp filler. So lamps at the time would have been filled with olive oil, typically. Olive oil would be contained in these giant jars that we called amphora. They could stand 3, 4, even 5 feet tall, and something that large, obviously it'd be very difficult to put oil into a lamp using something so big. And so these little lamp fillers were invented. You can see it just has a little small lip on it. I'll get both of these together. And so someone would take the lamp filler and dip it down into the amphora, get the oil, and then pour it into the lamp. And the lamp would be lit by some sort of a fiber, typically flax, something like that. And it would go in here, get wet with the olive oil, and then come out here and be lit on this side. And so that is the way lamps would work. So when you're reading in Samuel, and especially when we get to Kings next week, we're going to talk about Solomon. We're going to talk a little bit about the temple. And when you're talking about all of the furnishings that are inside the temple, lamps are mentioned several times. So that is what a lamp would have looked like. It would have sat on a stand. They talk about golden lampstands that are there, but that's what the lamp would look like. And you can see it sort of looks like the petals of a flower in a way. And that's what it reminds me of. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. These are the only artifacts that I own, so they'll be the only ones that I get to show on the podcast. But I hope you enjoyed that. And I hope it helps you to think about, David as that lamp of Israel, maybe a little bit differently. I hope it helps you to picture the ancient world a little bit better. Join me next week when we meet David and Bathsheba's surviving son, Solomon, who would build the temple, rule Israel during a time of peace, trade extensively with his neighbors, and build monumental cities that are still being excavated today. The Red-Haired Archaeologist podcast is researched, written, and recorded by me, Amanda Hope Haley. It is edited by Tanya Yurimkiv. New episodes are released each Thursday. To interact with me and other listeners, make sure you click the follow button on the Red-Haired Archaeologist pages on Facebook and Instagram. Then check out my website at redhairedarchaeologist.com, where you can subscribe to my monthly email, order signed copies of all my books, and schedule me to come speak in your town.